Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, chapter 4, the Hamshaguya. Prayers, text number 12. Tukanam pitarau bandhu. Drisha pakshma shtriha patihi. Pati prajanam bhikshunam. Grihi aghyanam buddhasurit. Dokanam of children. Pitarau, the two parents. Bandhu, the friends. Drisha, of the eye. Pakshma, the eyelid. Striyaha, of the woman. Patihi, the husband. Patihi, the protector. Prajanam, the subjects. Bhikshunam, of the beggars. Grihi, the householder. Agyanam, of the ignorant. Buddha, the learned. Suhrit, the friend. Translation. As the father and mother are the friends and maintainers of their children, as the eyelid is the protector of the eye, as the husband is the maintainer and protector of a woman, as the householder is the maintainer and protector of beggars, and as the learned is the friend of the ignorant, so the king is the protector and giver of life to all his subjects. The trees are also subjects of the king, therefore they should be given protection. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. By the supreme will of the personality of Godhead, there are various protectors and maintainers for helpless living entities. The trees are also considered prajas, subjects of the king, and therefore the duty of the monarch is to protect even the trees, not to speak of others. The king is duty bound to protect the living entities in his kingdom. Thus, although the parents are directly responsible for the protection and maintenance of their children, the duty of the king is to see that all parents do their duty properly. Similarly, the king is also responsible for overseeing the other protectors mentioned in this verse. It may also be noted that the beggars who should be maintained by the householders are not professional beggars, but sannyasis and brahmanas to whom the householders should supply food and clothing. So, a lot of material here, a lot of themes. But Srila Prabhupada begins the purport by saying, by the supreme will of the personality of God, that there are various protectors and maintainers for helpless living entities. The cosmic situation is arranged so that weaker people are protected by stronger people. Of course, a different arrangement is that weaker people are eaten by stronger people. The first canto is described. Jivo jivasya jivanam. Every living entity is food for another species. But at the same time, there is also the arrangement for protection, not only for killing. Because if, say, the parents had only the instinct to eat their children, the world would finish very soon. It's pretty obvious. So the Lord has arranged that there are nature protectors in a normal social situation. Not all countries are normal. Like we are from Europe, and obligatory education, public education is normal. We accept it as normal. In fact, it's obligatory. But there are countries where there is no public or free education. It's not obligatory. There are areas of the world where there is no education. Like, some places in Africa, there is no public or free education. We think that being a citizen with rights is normal, but there are countries of the world where it's very abnormal to be a slave, enslaved by others. Different types of slave, labor slave, and many other type of slavery. So, here, of course, we are talking about very elevated people. These are Vedic kings. And even the trees should be protected. In the Indian subcontinent, we have seen practically how the difference in policies between the state of Bhutan and the state of Nepal. In Nepal, due to greed, they cut all the trees, because trees is money. Trees is money for wood, for paper. Trees are money, and money is sitting there. So if somebody has a commercial mind, he sees trees, he sees money. So you have control of the tree, you have a lot of money. So in Nepal, they cut all the trees, and as a result, when there is floods, it's a huge disaster, because the tree keeps the earth. Not with the roots, they keep the earth. But when there are no trees, everything gets washed away. In Bhutan, the old king told the son, Bhutan is a Buddhist king. And ironically, Nepal was a very long time a Hindu kingdom. It was the only Hindu kingdom in the world. Now it's not anymore a Hindu kingdom. But ironically, in the Hindu kingdom, they cut all the trees. In the Buddhist kingdom, the king told the son that do not cut the trees. And they did not cut the trees. So in Bhutan, which is just very near Nepal, you go to West Bengal, and the north of West Bengal, one side is Bhutan, one side is Nepal. So it's the same, we could say topography, geography, climate. But in Bhutan, when there is rains, there are no major disasters, because the land doesn't get washed away. So it's not just charity that we protect the trees. It's not just compassion. You protect the trees, then the trees protect you. So, here there are many, also poetic. The eyelid is the protector of the eye. No? The eyelid protects the eye. It's instinctive. When there is some dust or something, immediately we close the eye. Would be very uncomfortable if we did not have eyelids. Imagine our eyes were forced open all day. You can close it. Fortunately, there is the eyelid. You can close it, and there is a reasonable protection from dust, from water, from light when we want to go to sleep. Okay. Children are the natural protector. The parents are the natural protector of the children. They have this instinct. This is my son. This is my daughter. I want the best for them. And then here it says, Srila Prabhupada explains, although the parents are directly responsible for the protection and maintenance of their children, the duty of the king is to see that all parents do their duty properly. So generally, parents want the education of the children. But say a couple doesn't want to educate their children for whatever reason. Some weird religious sentiment or just tamas guna, and they don't want to send children to school. Then the government will knock at the door, say, "Sir, we know you have a child. You got to send him to school. You have to send him to school." And if the parents are not willing, then they'll take the government will take the child away. Right? In Slovenia is like that, right? You cannot keep your child without education. The government will not allow you. So there's a level of protection, and there is a level that ensures that the protection is offered. Again, this is in normal circumstances. In Congo, probably you don't want to send a child to school. It's normal, first of all, because very often there are no schools to be sent the child. And second, because the government may not care at all. So protection tends to engender more protection. Like we see in the world, places where there is more education, there is more freedom. There is more civil freedom. Places where there is more ignorance, more illiteracy, there is more exploitation, more corruption. People don't have the tools to defend themselves, neither economically nor culturally. I was just reading something. What was it? Some Italian newspaper. I don't remember exactly, but I remember the dynamic. It was something that, say, for school expenses, you can not pay taxes. Something like that. Don't take it literally. But then it says that 50% of all the citizens, they don't know it. So there's a law that benefits them, but they don't know it, so they cannot take it. They cannot take advantage, right? So, this issue of protection brings forward the idea that there are natural hierarchies. There are natural hierarchies. Naturally, there are authorities. Authority means that the people who have the power to take decisions for others. Parents are natural authority for children. Children certainly cannot decide. Children are very innocent, very ignorant. They don't know how to read, they don't know anything. And so the parent, they have to have that authority. Huh? So it's a beneficial authority, it's a benevolent authority, but still it's authority. So the government has authority over the population. Like many populations, they don't like to put seat belts, right? Huh? Or they don't like to put helmets when they go on a bike. Because people are lazy, they feel invulnerable or something. Slovenian population generally is quite disciplined, no? And self-controlled. But I know places like Italy, they made this law, you had to put the seat belt. So there were some people who created t-shirts, white t-shirts with a black line. So that when the police looks from the outside, they see, oh, he has the seat belt. But actually it's only a t-shirt with a black line. Which is crazy, because the seat belt is good for you. It's not that the government gains something. I was in South India with a devotee. And there are different states in India, so there are different laws. Huh? And some states, it's obligatory to go with helmet when you go on a bike. Because, obviously, if you fall from the bike, your skull hits the asphalt and breaks. It's not a very difficult thing to understand, okay? So it's good for you to have a helmet, okay? It can save your life. But people are lazy. They don't want to carry the helmet. They don't want to... I was in South India with a devotee. We happened to go on a bike, and he told me, here there's no need of helmet. And I was kind of surprised. What does it mean? Because here the roads are made of rubber or soft cushions. So when your skull hits the floor, nothing happens. So this devotee, who, intelligent devotee, very smart. In fact, later he took sannyas and, you know, very smart devotee. But he thought that here the government doesn't impose the helmet, so you don't need to put the helmet. Apparently, he didn't, although a very intelligent devotee, he didn't make the connection that the helmet was for your good. It was not just to please the government or to avoid a fine. So I was a little surprised. What does it mean here that you need? I'd want a helmet. If I want to go for a bike ride, I want a helmet. Anyway, so sometimes the conditioned soul has this tendency to refuse something which is good. For us. Just out of laziness, out of sense of independence, out of sense of that nothing will happen to me, so I don't need to worry, like that. Then there is protection by men to women. Now, this is written a long time ago. Here it says, the husband is the maintainer, a protector of a woman. Now, in nowadays society, the economical relation between men and women is fastly shifting. Very often, in some families, is the women that maintain the men, or the women who have better jobs. In America, North America, it's very common that women have better jobs than men. Also because the economy shifted. Before, there were works which were more, suitable for men, because it involved physical strength. Men are stronger. Okay? So, manufacturing, factory work, even agriculture work. Okay? But nowadays, it's all done by machines. So, first of all, the men, and this is all statistics, men are more vulnerable to lose their jobs, because they close the factory. Or they send the jobs to China. And the women, who don't have that physical strength, or generally don't do work which are depending on physical strength, they do things which are relation to relations, no? Communication, like a nursing, teaching, which is not based on physical strength. So very often happens in some area of America. The men lose the jobs, and women have the jobs, and they earn much more. So, this is a bit obvious, it's not a fixed thing. Of course, women need protection. Srila Prabhupada said, a boy who is 16 years old can travel all over the world. A girl who is 16 years old cannot. It's very dangerous. Maybe not in Ljubljana, Slovenia, but in general, a young girl is extremely dangerous to just travel alone. You get, I don't know how much you read newspaper, but you have this news that, you know, girls traveling alone, sometimes they are raped and killed, and there is a burgeoning slave trade, and they take children and women. Millions of women and children, they are slaves. And nearby here, you know, Eastern Europe is a major hub of kidnapping people and selling them into prostitution or into slavery. So, although the economic landscape, cultural landscape changes, there are certain, say, laws of nature don't change. It's good for a man, for a woman, to be protected by a man. I mean, women probably have this experience. You walk alone. I don't know in Slovenia, but I know that in other parts of the world, you walk alone, men start looking at you in a very particular way, or they start saying things like, "Hey, beauty," or "Hey, baby," or something like that. When you walk with a man, they won't say anything. Any of you have this experience? Why you laugh? You're not a woman. People don't say baby to you. I'm saying, they have this experience. It is, oh baby, what do you do tonight? Yeah, I know, I understand. Yeah, it's a different psychology. Yeah, but it's heavy, you know, it's heavy. Not anymore. Yeah, time passes. No, but actually, it's heavy for a woman. Very disturbing. For most women, let's say, it's for most women, it's extremely disturbing. You have to walk in the street, and people look at you, and people tell you things like that. They made another sociological experiment in New York. There's a video. One girl, normal girl, walks in the street. Normal t-shirt and jeans. Okay? And like they calculated, I don't remember, in 1 kilometer, how many men approaches her? Same things. Hey, beauty. You know, like things like that. Huh? Then she puts a burqa, an Islamic attire, and nobody talks with her. No one person talks with her. So now I'm not promoting burqa in burqa, but I'm just saying that gives some degree of protection. Anyway, so we went from trees to burqas and talking about Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Actually, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know, he wrote 100 books. And one book is about the exploitative marriage practice in West Bengal. You know, he was a judge. He wrote a book on how certain practices were very cruel towards women in West Bengal. So he had that social awareness, social consciousness. As there are natural hierarchies in life, there are also hierarchies within the acharyas. You know, like our sampradaya is not just the list of all the gurus in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, because there were thousands of gurus. So that when we say sampradaya, parampara, like when it's at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, it's not just all the gurus that there were ever. There are the main acharyas, those who have contributed some special shiksha. And in many cases, there were many other gurus, maybe very great souls and everything, self-realized souls, but they did not contribute particular shiksha, they did not particular book, or they were not prominent. And so, they're not listed. So just like there are different hierarchies, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur is very high, even within our acharyas. Srila Bhakti Charu Maharaj was giving a course on the GBC College, and he was saying it's an extreme rarity that in a sampradaya, three big acharyas, they appear so close to each other. You have Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, then his son, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, and then you have Srila Prabhupada. Basically, one after another. And to some extent, contemporary. Like, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur left this world when Srila Prabhupada was 18. Just to give a reference. Okay. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was born in this world 1838. So today he will be 180 years old. And these acharyas, although they from a different centuries, he left this world more than a century ago, but due to their relevance, to their power, to their brilliance, they tend to become more and more relevant as the time goes on. This is a dynamic which we actually already seen in Europe. For instance, there are these classic Greek authors like Aristotle or Plato, like the fathers, could say, of European philosophy, Greek and therefore European philosophy. And there was a time in which they were completely forgotten. The Dark Ages, most people didn't know how to read, and there was, if they read, they only read the church books and things like that. Plus there were no books, printed books. So the whole Europe didn't know about Aristotle and Plato, were just forgotten. Then there was an Islamic scholar, his Latin name is Avicenna, around the year 1000. He rediscovered, he was very broad-minded. He said, wow, this is good philosophy. Although he was a Muslim, he said, wow, this Aristotle is cool, this Plato is cool. So he translated things, and Europe rediscovered its cultural roots through a Muslim scholar. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it's the type of acharya. He wrote again 100 books. He wrote in Sanskrit, he wrote in Bengali, he wrote in English, and more and more people will read his books in the future. More and more, as Gaudiya Vaishnavism become known, popular, appreciated, people will start discovering. In fact, at the time of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there were other intellectuals, Bengali intellectuals, which were more famous than him. No? Different poets, like that. They were more famous, because he was famous within the devotional environment. They were more famous mundane illiterates. But then, now, of course, we never practically heard about them. Oh, it's because the time changed. Something that is prominent now, it becomes irrelevant later. Something that is less known now, it becomes very famous later. So, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur will become more and more famous. Because when people appreciate the message of the Bhagavatam, the message of the Gita, the message of Srila Prabhupada, naturally the whole culture, the whole tradition, the whole heritage, the whole legacy will become more and more familiar to people. Just like Shakespeare, 500 years ago, is still very much in vogue, especially if you are born in England. But in general, you have people who are always popular. They are considered like a fixed point in the culture. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur is and will remain a very prominent acharya in our line. Okay, it's 8:45. Is there any question or comments? We have him. You, what's that? Raising your pen, basically. Okay, yes. I'm wondering, do we need a mic or anything, or no? No, because I was in Prabhupada Desh, and as soon as the question answer start, you hear from the pujari, mic! So I don't want to. Pujaris, better not to irritate pujaris. First of all, because they are great souls. Second, because generally they have control of Mahaprasad.
Hare Krishna. I'm wondering, yesterday you said about Jiva Goswami that he was he written on palm leaves and these things, and it was like 500 years ago. How is that that there is no paper?
There might have been paper, but I don't have a full historical answer. There might have been paper, but that have been also very rare, very costly. See, the process was not an industrial process. This is a totally pre-industrial. And so maybe, I mean, I don't know, but maybe palm leaves is more cheap, more available, you know. Paper, in some cases, historically, is extremely rare, extremely costly. Sometimes it's not even available. I mean, we know from Srila Prabhupada, when he got this first Back to God magazine, his first article was, "Thanks to the government of India." Because it was during the Second World War, and the government of India rationed paper. You could not get paper. You had the special permission because they kept paper just for the war efforts, whatever, or for government publications. You could not buy paper. And this is in the 20th century. So Srila Prabhupada said, thanks to the government of India because they allowed us to use paper. So apparently in Vrindavan, 16th century, paper were not that available.
Yeah, I understand. Because you mentioned Aristotle, Platon, they were written on paper, and it was like...
On paper?
I suppose.
Possible.
I suppose, you know. At least in, you know, movies, it's like that.
Okay. Possible. No, see, it would be nice, we could easily Google it, the history of paper, you know. So some say that the paper was invented in China, and right now I don't know the history of paper. But maybe in Greece 2,000 years ago, paper was more easily available. Sorry.
It's okay.
Even paper, I mean, just as a curiosity, even paper has got its own shelf life. You know, paper doesn't last forever. So you have a book on paper, doesn't mean you have it for 1,000 years. So in around 1,000 current era, Christian era, it means that it's more than 1,000 years after Aristotle. So books generally don't last 1,000 years. So that's the nature of this world. There is entropy. Everything gets just destroyed. In fact, you see, when the archaeologists find basically inscriptions in stone, because paper, there's no more paper anymore. Like, it's very rare. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now they found these little pieces here and there. Time destroys these things. Him and then you. Yes.
Hare Krishna. I am very much interested in everything about Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So I want to hear more. I made some 4 points of what you said. First is the marriage system in Bengal, this essay he wrote against the schooling Brahmins and so on. And second is Sampradaya is not the least of all the gurus. Now, you quickly mentioned some points, but I don't know why and in which context. And then I would like to also know Bhakti Charuswami seminar, three big acharyas so rare to appear so close to each other. I would like to know which seminar, if it was this year, to search out. And the fourth point I wrote is Bhaktivinoda will become a prominent acharya in the future.
I said it will be more and more prominent and more famous.
And more, okay, so if you can also elaborate on that.
Okay, first point is the I didn't read that essay. I just know that it exists. I read it in the list of books. You know the list of books. You are a Bhagavad-gita scholar. So there is a book like the Seven Goswami, and there Rupa Vilas Prabhu gives the list of all the books, and then he puts a paragraph on this book. So I don't know much of the contents. It may be available somewhere. I'm sure in in some Calcutta library must be available. As a sidebar, we could say that obviously not everything is what is traditional, or not everything which is Indian is good, necessarily good. Certain practices are only... I don't know what practices he was objecting to, so I'm not sure exactly what's in the book. Huh? Okay, this is an example. I don't know if the movie is, you say no, but whatever. But, even the sati, this is a rite which is Vedic. It was a voluntary thing. Yeah, because the wife apparently, first of all, knew she was not a body. Second, she knew that I'll go wherever my husband is. Third, they were married very young, so very often the husband was everything in their life. No, if they are 8 year old, they may have lived 68 years with the husband. No, and so for them was more the burning of the separation than the burning of the fire. Once, by the way, I asked the devotee doctor, I say, how does it happen when you go and jump in the fire? He said, actually you die of suffocation more than burnings. Because, any doctor here? Medical doctor? No. But they say, because, you enter the fire, the fire burns the oxygen, so you actually die of suffocation. You don't die roasted in the fire. So it doesn't last long. It's like a few seconds, you lose consciousness and you go. But at one point, widows were forced. You had to follow your husband. And maybe those widows had other plans, like a dentist appointment or some other plans in life. So they didn't want to jump. And then they became a murder. Can kill people if they don't want to die. So, and then the British had to stop it. They saw it. Wow, what's going on? They had to make it. So certain rules are for very elevated people. When people are not so elevated, or the guardians are not so elevated or mature or wise, then the practices should stop. Like early marriage. I mean, we could talk hours just about early marriage. It's a practice which Srila Prabhupada talks about it. It's practiced in the Indian culture before. There's even a statement in some shastra that the father has to arrange the marriage of the daughter before her first menstrual period. But this is something for a culture in which really the men are protectors. They really take responsibility. They don't marry just as a for carnal desires, sexual desires. So in a culture where the man is really protector, then early marriage or big difference between husband and wife makes sense. In nowadays culture, doesn't make any sense anymore, largely. Besides, it's also forbidden in most countries. You can't marry a 12-year-old girl. I don't think in Slovenia would be legal. The minimum what? 18? 16? Okay. So besides the fact it's illegal, but there are reasons they're illegal. Not because just the government is demoniac, you know. No, it's because they see that no, very young girl can be very easily exploited. Can be very easily exploited. And then, you know, the husband leaves, the girl has one child, two child, no education, no jobs. So certain rules, which are for the protection, if people are not qualified, they become exploited. So anything which is good in the hand of somebody, which is not good, it becomes bad. You give a knife to your cook, he will cut into very nice thing. If you give a knife to a criminal, he may mug people in the street. So obviously, you know, it's not the knife, but knife is power. So you give knife to somebody, you give you a weapon. If the person is good, it's for protection. It's good that the police has got guns, right? If they are nice police, right? But if a criminal, the same guns in the hands of criminals become very, very dangerous. Second.
I want to add some comments.
Sure.
Yeah. I read this essay, I have it, Marriage System in Bengal, 1871.
So what was your question? You'd already read it.
No, I mentioned some. So in this book, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is not speaking about sati, because sati was forbidden about 40 years earlier by the English, but he is speaking against child marriage of girls age 5. So he is suggesting for the girls to be married at the age of 11 after the menstrual period starts, as he married all of his daughters at the age 10, 11, 12. And he's also objecting to the polygamy of this Kulina Brahmana, the highest caste of Brahmins, who married about 64 to 108 wives each. Oh. So in this essay he is against this. So I was also, if you can tell me about Sampradaya, the list of guru. What is the...
Okay, meaning? Let's go back to this marriage, early marriage, because you mentioned. See, 11 years old, like Srila Prabhupada, when he married, at least, again, official marriage, the wife of Srila Prabhupada was 11 years old. And he says that. And he says also that the culture was the parents were really eager to get their daughters married. It was just because protecting, because the idea was, if my daughter is married before she reaches puberty. The idea was the marriage was before puberty, but then they will live together after puberty. That is the idea. But the idea was that if my daughter is married before puberty, when she reaches puberty, she was already as a man in her mind. And Srila Prabhupada explained that they were not living together, but the girl will cook for the husband, you know, they'll see each other cook, this is your chutney, this is your puri, this is your whatever. And so there was that affection. They're young. Maybe the husband is 16, 18, 20, like that. So, and when the girl gets puberty already, she has a man to fix. Otherwise the concept was, okay, she reached puberty, her natural desires starts becoming prominent, and then she looks for men. She starts thinking of, but now she already has a man. Huh? So that will be her man for life. Srila Prabhupada even tells the mother of Srila Prabhupada, there was another sister who could not get married. It was, I don't know, 13, 14, something like that. Huh? 13 or 14. And the mother was telling the father, Gormohande, you had to marry this. You got to arrange the marriage for this daughter. If you don't do it, I'll jump in the Ganga. I'll commit suicide. And it was only, 13, 14? No, but it was such a big deal. Srila Prabhupada say, the father said, yeah, I'm trying. You know, I can't find the husband. Sorry. I'm trying. So culture. But Srila Prabhupada also said, now it's different. He said, you know, I did a little study on that, and when he was talking about those things, he also said, today is different. Today is different. Because those people, imagine, you know, a nice Vaishnava, these were all like Vaishnava families. Vaishnava families. So imagine a nice boy, very responsible, very sattvic, very gentle, controlled by the parents, basically throughout life. Throughout life. And so, you get a very young girl, 12-year-old girl, and he will not run away. And the statistics shows that they were not running away. They were stable. They were stable. So even if the wife was not very educated, she was not economically independent, was okay. Because the idea was, you get married, you start having children, the wife is busy with the children, busy with the home, the husband goes, works, brings money. And you know, that's life. That's like traditional life. But nowadays it's not like that. Nowadays, obviously, where are these men who are super responsible, super stable, super loyal? What's the rate of divorce in Slovenia? Yeah, around 50%. So like it's a coin toss, you know? Head or tail. It's just like, it's almost gambling, you know? Like a roulette, red or black. You know, it's like, will it work or not? So in this condition, obviously you can't leave a girl unprotected. Because if she doesn't have education, she doesn't have a job, she cannot get a job, and the husband leaves, what she'll do? Right? What she'll do? In that culture, she was protected. Because men were protectors. But in this culture, it's not applicable anymore. See, let's understand the principle. When we talk about social life, social interaction, everything is interdependent. When we talk about philosophy, things are absolute. You have Radha Krishna in the spiritual world, you have Radha Krishna in the spiritual world. Doesn't depend on anything else. Doesn't depend on the government, doesn't depend on the weather, doesn't depend on the economy. It's a fact. Tattva. But when we talk about sociology, everything is interdependent. So a rule which in a certain situation may be good, in another situation it becomes horrible. Like Srila Prabhupada speaks sometimes, Shudras, they will not have money. Right? They will not have money. They will not have cash. And they will get clothes, they will get food, they will get facilities, but they will not bank money. Shudras will not have their bank accounts. But the culture was that the people they will employ Shudras was for life. I remember there was a devotee in Mayapur, now he's in Alachua. The devotee in Mayapur is from a Marwari family, a business community in India, very cultural, Vaishnava, Marwari family. And he had the shop, you know the shop in the courtyard of the Mayapur? Now there's no shop anymore, there's an office. But before there was Vaikuntha Bandar, some of you remember that shop, okay? And he was managing it for ISKCON. And he had this, his servants, and he explained how these are servants for life. These are the servants of my family. And we have this very strong value, we have to maintain them. It's not like nowadays you hire somebody after 2 months, you knock him off. You downsize, you fire people. So, if you have good Vaishyas, good Kshatriyas, good Brahmanas, they take the Shudras and they take as a part of their family. They take as part of their family. They're Shudras, but they're part of the family. They're servants, they're assistants. They have the sense of duty. I have to make them happy. Then, even if the Shudras don't have money, it's fine. But nowadays, imagine there is some unscrupulous, ruthless businessman. Imagine if the government allows him not to pay his people. There will be a lot of exploitation. Like there is in many countries of the world. Therefore, the government has to say, no, you had to pay. Like yesterday, we were talking with Mrigendra Prabhu. No, he has his employees and he follows the law. So he has to pay for insurance, he has to pay for pension, he has to pay. Because the government forces you. The government doesn't trust you. Doesn't trust you that you will take care of these people because you are a person of integrity. No. The government is trying to protect, like we're reading, they are protecting the people from exploitation. So if you go to work for somebody, then the government say, yeah, but you have to pay for this, you have to pay for that, and so on and so forth. By the way, talking about government, I talk about protection. The government here apparently is very protective to its citizens. There is like a welfare kind of mood. And I hear a little bird told me that a lot of devotees are on welfare. Did you ever hear about that? Okay. So, I mean, I hear another little bird told me that the mood is, you know, we are brahmanas. We are supposed to be maintained by the kshatriyas, the kings. So it's fine. I don't work and the government pays me. Now, in theory, again, in a Vedic milieu, in a Vedic environment, it makes sense. But, dear devotees, if you are listening to me, wherever you are, if you are on welfare, it's okay if you are really 100% a brahmana. In other words, if you spend your time learning and teaching, learning and propagating spiritual knowledge, then it's okay. Then you do have a right to be maintained. But if you are spacing out on YouTube or even worse places all day, just because the government is paying you, be careful. Because there is no free lunch. You know the expression, there is no free lunch? In other words, you get the money, but that money is full of karma. I don't know the main taxpayers in Slovenia, but probably some ugra karmic thing. What's the major, some industries? Meat, leather, casinos, maybe some casinos also? Huh? Tobacco. So you're getting money from the government gets money from the tobacco industry, from the meat industry, from some other beautiful industries. You get that money. If you don't use that money 100%, be careful. That money is heavy. That money is radioactive. So you get the money, could be fine, but you have to be 100% a brahmana. If you're less than a brahmana, that money can burn you. End of the editorial. Yeah, if you're doing that, fine. If you're getting the money, giving to Sri Pashi Panchatattva, fine. But if you're just pacing out, smoking joints, if, no? The word if is the key. And another shorter editorial. Also think that as a Hare Krishna, you know, there's also a question of reputation. How do you want to be seen? How do you want to be seen? The new movement. People know who is who. And, you know, are you okay that the government of this country thinks that Hare Krishnas are just parasites? You understand the word parasite? They're just basically exploiting the system without producing anything. Are you okay with that? That you want to contribute to build that reputation? So there are different considerations. End of the second editorial. Then the parampara. Ah, we finished, yes, sorry. I went over because Prabhu also told me today no breakfast, so people will not be so eager to get out. Huh? Why should we finish? Finish? Is that why you are finishing the lecture? So am I finishing the lecture? Of what time I'm finishing the lecture? Okay, so the parampara. What's the doubt there?
Just a point. Maybe irrelevant to the rest of the topic. Second point, you mentioned the font. But the third point is a disseminar.
The third point is about... If you know, Bhakti Charu Swami made a seminar.
Yeah, Bhakti Charu Maharaj presented this seminar at the GBC College, and it became a standard course. The importance of the institution, basically, and he explained how the contribution to the creation of the institution of both Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada. And I mean, they organized the movement, no? They brought the movement, Lord Chaitanya's movement, into the modern era. And again, this is what it made the point, that there are three very powerful, very empowered acharyas, three very empowered authors, spiritual leaders, that they just came one after another, which is, you know, many... what other sampradayas can say we have this type of acharyas, especially right now? No, of course, if you go to Ramanuja Acharya, Vedanta Deshika, but that's 1,000 years ago. You know, so it's a major thing that in fact, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur Pranam Mantra is Namo Bhakti Vinodaya. Namo Bhaktivinodaya Satchatyananda Namine Gora Shakti Swarupaya Rupanuga Varayate. Gora Shakti Swarupa is a Swarupa of Gora Shakti. It's like really empowered. Really empowered. And he was working in a very difficult situation, because see, he was Bengali, so he was very much very much Bengali, we could say. You know, he knew Bengali. He was born in Birnagar, which is about an hour from Mayapur. Huh? And then, of course, he studied also a lot in the English system. So he knew perfect English, and so he was let's say in between. Not the traditional Bengal. He grew up in a kind of countryside. And there was this guard who would read always the Ramayana to him. So, from one side, he was grew up as a traditional Hindu, we could say. At the same time, as a student, he was also exposed a lot to the British influence. There was a priest that he preached to him for many, many, many years, and he liked you know, the Gospels. He liked the sense of, you know, the bhakti mood of Jesus and so on. And then this priest really always hoped to kind of convert him. At one time, you know, Kedarnath Datta would become a Christian. He never became. And there was this whole movement of Bengali intellectual. Calcutta was the capital of India at the time. So the capital also culturally. So there was all these Bengali intellectuals which were kind of shifting towards the Western mood, no? And so it was a very, very particular. There is this beautiful book called Kedarnath Datta, Hindu Encounter with Modernity. You have it? And he explains where Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was active. So he had a lot of, we could say, audiences. One, he had the British audience. So you all know he sent this book, Life and Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, all the way to Canada, to the McGill University. So he had in his mind, this is how Acharya think, you know, the Acharyas think like that, think about the world. So one sense, he wanted to influence the British culture all over the world, the English culture all over the world, and the world in general. Then they wanted to influence the Bengali educated people, No, so he wrote also in English, he wrote in Sanskrit. Sanskrit was not for everybody. At the same time, he also started this movement of Namahata, which was for very popular, no? So he would write some, all these Bengali songs, which many would become, for them and for us, became part of our daily liturgy. Like Gaurarti, we have it here. Like here in Ljubljana, we sing Gaurarti by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So many of these songs were for his followers for the daily practice. And still we follow that. No? Through Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, through Srila Prabhupada, now we have here, we have the, no, we change Radha Madhava, we change Sari Ravi Dejal today at 12 o'clock, but, you know, we change Sari Ravi Dejal every day. It's part of our life, of the texture of our life, because he gave a Krishna conscious framework to everything. He did a book like the Siddhanta, Vaishnava Siddhanta Mala. It was like catechism, question and answers, to train all his followers. He had, we heard, 500 groups all over Bengal. And those groups were not called Namahata. Namahata was the overall picture, the market of the holy name. He wrote this book, Gudruma Kalpatavi. How many of you read the book, Gudruma Kalpatavi? You have? Jap Thakur Maharaj translated from Bengal. He gave a purport. Gudruma Kalpatavi describes how his movement was organized. And then the Vaishnava Siddhanta Mala was a book like for training people in philosophy very systematically, so that they could learn the philosophy and they could also answer questions of people. So they were very, very, very systematic. Like Jehovah's Witness now, they have books how to answer different questions. Huh? They have books for their own people. Say, okay, that's a flattering actually. But they say, okay, if they ask you why to use this Bible, not that Bible, so they have the answer. It's very systematic. So he equipped his people, and he equipped them with the very strong values. For instance, the rule was in his movement. The rule was that the Grihastha should not beg. Here the verse talks about the Bhikshanam, the beggars. But because in West Bengal, Vaishnavism was really degraded. No? All this Apa Sampradaya, he wrote a book, the 13 Apa Sampradaya. So the mood of the educated people, the respectable people, is that these Vaishnavas are just beggars. They were not on welfare because they were not welfare, but otherwise they would have been on welfare. But they were just beggars. I mean, how many of you took the train from Calcutta to Mayapur? So you see sometimes some beggars come and they sing Hare Krishna, right? You've seen? Some family, some blind people, Hare Krishna, and they go and then you give 2 rupees and they go. And that was Vaishnava, Bengali Vaishnavism at the time of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and much more worse thing. Those are trees that are just beggars, but there were much worse things. People dressed like gopis and had beards because they think, you know, I will attract Krishna by dressing like a woman. So many really crazy things. And he was in the middle of all that. So he made a rule. In your Namahatas, you need mridangas, you need kartas, you pay with your own money. You don't get donations. Because otherwise people feel, oh, another beggar. So you buy your mridanga, you pay, you make your flags, you know, at home. You don't take donations. Otherwise they will spoil their reputation. Again, that's another instruction which is not forever. No, it's not that now, okay, don't sell books, don't ask money. No. But at that time, that was essential. Just like Srila Prabhupada. He established the movement in the West, a lot of Harinam, a lot of Harinam in the street. But then when he went to India, he changed. Because in India, Harinam was for beggars. So he stopped the Harinam in India. And he started the life membership. You go more, okay, we have these books, so we are a respectable organization. You give us 1,111 rupees, you become a member of our society. It shifted the strategy. The strategy needs to see the terrain. You cannot have the same strategy if you have mountains or if you have lakes, obviously. No, so depending on the mood, depending on the culture, you have to. So we can learn a lot from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, how he did. And I'll close with this. His groups, as I said, were not called Namahatta, they were called Prapannashrams. Ashrams of surrender, Prapannashram. And our preachers, Namahatta preachers in West Bengal, they even found two or three groups that were still going on since Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur time. No, because the children, you know, the children, we are talking about late 19th centuries, then we are talking about late 20th century, so some groups were going on for 100 years, like 3-4 generations, somehow they were still coming together and chanting Hare Krishna. I was told that they found these groups in somewhere in West Bengal. They said they were still calling Prapannasha. No, no problem. Doubts are a symptom of intelligence. No, it was Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so have a great celebration and Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.